When I arrived in Tirana, it was still very hot. The parched city fell silent each afternoon as it tucked itself away into a siesta. But on Sundays, the September air was filled with the jubilant blare of wedding cavalcades. 10 or even 15 sagging old Mercedes at a time, weighed down by euphoric revellers hanging out the doors, whirligigging round the faded nationalist bravura of Skanderbeg Square, before coursing in wild abandon and billows of choking dust down the once grand Boulevard des Morites Combit, Martyrs of the Nation. I had a two-room apartment in a collapsing 1950s socialist block, its walls marbled with cracks, like a hard-boiled egg about to be peeled. It was the kind of space usually filled by a family of 6 to 8 people, but I had it all to myself. A small bedroom, a small sitting room, with a balcony looking towards Mount Dighty, which at 5,000 feet stood out in colours like a relief map, its balding summit, baked biscuit brown in summer, snow-covered in winter, dominating low-rise Tirana. Part of the balcony was tented over with plyboard and thick polythene to form a makeshift kitchen, and there was a tiny bathroom with rusting showerhead, basin and loo. A flush of any toilet on the few floors above would send a wave of stench cresting through my space, temporarily overwhelming the pervading odour of wet concrete and putrid decay. That appeared to come from just outside, where, in the literal shit heap of the yard, some guys were building another apartment block face up against mine. Every morning at 7 a.m, 7 days a week, the cement mixer started up with a gurgling roar, a choke of diesel, and a scraping shovelling of gravel, endlessly stuffing its rumbling, churning belly. It was a race to the finish between the new builders and the occupants of my block, who were DIYing like crazy while there was still a bit of space left to do so. Balconies were being frenziedly extended to make new rooms, teetering constructions straining and pulling the original building almost to breaking point. There'd be a terrible thumping, pounding, a hellish drilling for hours at a time, sending ominous lumps of plaster raining down from the ceilings. When the builders clocked off at 5 p.m, the rats would emerge, scuttling back and forth, gnawing, scratching, within the cavities of the apartment's thin walls. Those first evenings, I'd sit on my balcony and read by the light of a candle stuck to the concrete windowsill in a puddle of greasy wax. I'd look out across the streets, to the stars shimmering over Mount Dighty and the low-slung lamp of the moon, and watch the last of the Mercedes roll home. It would get so quiet, and then the dogs would start. The nights were filled with barking dogs and the steady gnawing of the rats tunnelling within the walls. I'd arrived alone from London just a few weeks earlier, with £50, a spare can of petrol, and a deep conviction. Albania was about to hit a great big snag. I was frantic to sell some news stories, not that I'd ever written one before in my life. My first blue-lined reporter's notebooks give some idea of the state of the nation I found myself in. There was widespread amoebic dysentery in the south, diphtheria in the north, and measles rife in the centre, along with an outbreak of polio serious enough for the World Health Organization to intervene. All this in a country with a shortage of even basic medicines. It was clear Albania was in a mess. Mafia speedboats from the southern port of Vlora turned back from Italy. This time it was 70 Kurds, 25 Macedonians, 15 Albanians. Violent crime on the rise. Two policemen killed in an ambush. Police chief shot dead while eating breakfast. Director General of Prisons killed by 6 bullets fired at his head and stomach through the windscreen of his car. A bomb wrecks the apartment block of the chairman of the Court of Appeal. Albanian gangs running incursions into Kosovo intercepted on both sides of the border. 2 Albanians arrested in Kosovo for a series of terrorist attacks against Serbian police and civilians, said to be part of a large, well-armed group. The booming business of the Orkadia wedding agency, which began with a 55-year-old widow marrying a very wealthy Italian, even though she didn't speak a word of his language. Hundreds of women now signing up to go to Italy on what are promised to be dream-come-true futures, but more likely forced prostitution. and the children, sold by their parents for cash, to those making promises of a better future for them abroad. My first news stories, a minute or two of airtime, a rare print column inch grab. With no telephone of my own, filing could be complicated. I dashed down to the Dighty, a grand 1941 Italian functionalist-style hotel on Martyrs of the Nation Boulevard, where, back in the not-so-distant years of Enver Hoxha's communist dictatorship, any rare international visitors were put up in carefully bugged, rather threadbare guest rooms, all conversation being relayed directly to the listening spy staff in their secret office deep below the basement. A system that was still in operation at the hotel's claustrophobic international line phone booth. Access was closely guarded by an attendant, who needed to be paid with a large pile of lek bills, which were then counted out slowly.
30 a nonte, 12, 12 a ni, 12 a due, 12 a tre.
While the black hands on the 1960s wall clock nudged remorselessly towards deadline. The whir click of the sluggish dial, 14 digits to London, then the hollow, airy hiss of the bugging machine starting up in the bowels of the building's foundations, a draughty rippling in my ear like distant friendly machine gun fire, then a bleep.
Hello, copy!
The Guardian newspaper copy taker's office on Farringdon Road, London EC1. Where? Albania? Start dictating now, please. Then, word by word, 500 or so would trickle down the line into the headset of the dogged copy taker who'd be inputting to the foreign news desk. My jaws working hard to enunciate clearly all those Albanian names bristling with exotic XHs. There was little worse in those days than hearing the dreaded sentence cheerily delivered from London EC1. Oh, drat, something's gone wrong in the system. Could you run through that again, please? Any news worth knowing was to be picked up in bars and restaurants. So, the day started with a string of coffees drunk in the shade of acacia trees and umbrella pines at the many kiosk cafes that had sprouted up and almost obliterated what was once Tirana's central Rinia Park. Those cafes, named aspirationally after places and heroes, the Berlin, the California, the Muhammad Ali, the President, played a vital role in setting the agenda for the day. For it was here, amidst the cheap cigarette smoke, the click of billiard balls, and the blare of cassette tape techno, that rumours were heard. Rumours which, however eye-stretching at breakfast, were guaranteed to be fact before sunset. Events were chewed over again at lunch, where the speciality at the Suzette was deep-fried brains and hot chocolate. I, understandably, preferred the London, where one was serenaded at the table by the brilliant former principal violin of the long-since-scattered Albanian Philharmonic, a musician now desperate to be hired in Italy. Dinner was always at Il Passatore, the Brigand, known simply as Antonella's, a restaurant that was to Tirana what Rick's Bar was to Casablanca in Michael Curtis's 1942 film. Restaurateur sans frontières, Antonella likes to call herself. In her 40s, she's a broad, warm, strong Italian woman from the Emilia-Romagna. There she sits at the corner of the bar, writing the bills, calling out to customers, joining friends at their tables. Behind her, a row of old limoncello liqueur bottles, now filled with local raki, catches the light reflected by a mirror, in which I can see the head of the World Bank mission eating tagliatelle with fresh prawns and peperoncino, deep in conversation with the US military advisor to the Albanian Ministry of Defence. There are politicians, expat NGO types, beautiful girls with rich gangsters, Albanian and Italian businessmen carving up the spoils over G&T aperitifs. The Polish ambassador is chewing over Turkey, the country, with the finance minister, who's just asked me to marry him. Again. Step out with me into the blare of midday Tirana, across Skanderbeg Square, dazzling white under the blazing sun. Walk past the beggars. The man in a wide straw hat, no legs below the knees, who smites the ground with his stick in reproachful tattoo, shuffling along on worn leather pads, shouting for attention. And babies on the ground, every few yards or so, laid out on pieces of cloth like random offerings. At the foot of the statue of Skanderbeg, the country's 15th century national hero, a woman squats selling American chewing gum and packets of Turkish snacks, her thick makeup growing tacky in the heat. And a bootblack tosses his brush into the air, over and over, sending it up, spinning high into the peacock blue sky. Press on, into the Warrener streets, marked out by stumps of trees long since felled for firewood. The mud underfoot, thick with bits of animal bone, pieces of glass, tin Tirana beer bottle tops, ashes from dead fires, ground in by thousands of passing feet. Three gutted pigs crawling with flies hang by their knotted hind trotters from a tree. There's a rancid stench from spoiling butter being sold in pale yellow greasy slabs, and hot corn scorching and blackening on braziers over fires of twigs and rubbish. On either side are once elegant Italianate villas and palazzini, designed and built in the 1920s and 30s during the reign of King Zog by some of the most fashionable Florentine and Roman architects of their time. They're now crumbling to bits, their peeling walls faded pastel by the sun into shades of pistachio, stale mustard, powder blue, their decorative facades veiled by the washed-out colours of strings of drying laundry. Some are blessed by the holy halo of a satellite dish. All have been gradually, innocently caught up in the lethal spaghetti of mains electric power cables, which wrap them around before sagging perilously low across the street to ensnare the dilapidated villas opposite. Until Mussolini annexed Albania in 1939 and forced King Zog to flee, the two had been thick as thieves, even sharing the same taste in architecture. For his royal palaces and the great Skanderbeg Square, Zog commissioned Floristano di Fausto, the architect who did for Mussolini what Albert Speer did for Hitler. When Il Duce took power, he transformed the city in 2 short years into a fascist Italian rationalist-style dream. By 1996, these extraordinary buildings, standing neglected amidst poverty and chaos, gave out an eerie atmosphere, particularly during the deserted hours of siesta, when Tirana seemed to slip into the surreal world of Giorgio di Chirico's paintings, sharing those same enigmatic colonnaded buildings, surreal lonely towers, and that pervasive atmosphere of melancholy vacuum, creeping unease and oppressive mystery. The uncertainty of Tirana, that was the mood, a feeling of approaching menace just beneath the strong sunlight and cold shadows. It was on one such afternoon that I went to interview the head of the International Monetary Fund's visiting mission to Tirana. My notes run thus. Economy really strong, growth 10%, inflation's come right down, prices have stabilised. Pyramid investment schemes very common in these kind of situations, but absolutely no cause for concern. He was about to be proved breathtakingly wrong.